Well, good morning. My name is Jim Todd. I'm the pastor of Outreach here, and I'm glad that you are here. As you briefly heard, today is PG-13. So if your kids are still here with you, that's cool. Just conversation might be lively in the car on the way home. And then they asked a 20-year youth veteran to talk about the sex talk as an anchor in the marriage series. And Pastor Brian patted me on the back and said, "Go for it, buddy, go for it." So what could I say that's wrong, right? Have you ever heard the saying, you were just in the right place at the right time? Meaning, you were just where you needed to be for something amazing to happen. So Vin Scully is perhaps a revered announcer of the game. He is one of the reasons I will be a Dodger fan for the rest of my life. Other than the fact that I've talked so much smack about it, you guys wouldn't respect me if I turned and became a Giant fan now, right? But this guy in his final season, 2016, there was Vin Scully bobblehead night. So I went down, my cousin and I sat in left field and took in the game, and I'm kind of going, what am I going to do with a bobblehead for the rest of my life? But Vin Scully is like an epic guy. And I went home that Tuesday night. On Sunday, 5 days later, he's calling the last game at Dodger Stadium. And after the game, well, before the game ended, rookie Corey Seager, with two outs in the bottom of the ninth, hits a home run to tie the score. And then a guy, Charlie Culberson, comes up clutch, hits a two-run home run to advance the Dodgers into the playoffs. So I'm like in my front room just screaming, my voice is hoarse, and I'm thinking, okay, ESPN will cut away to something else, but they didn't. They stayed right there, and they kept playing. My voice is hoarse, I'm thinking I need a drink, and I'm going towards the kitchen, and then Vin Scully and his wife were addressing the crowd from the announcer's booth. This is a wife that he had married 25 years earlier. His original wife had passed away and he then remarried. And they were talking about, they sang this song, "Wind Beneath My Wings," on his wedding day. And he sang it to his wife. But they were now saying, "You, the fan base of LA, you're truly the wind beneath our wings." And I'm sitting there going, yeah, I didn't like that song when it came out. So I'm going towards the kitchen, and it's playing, and I'm sitting there going, that is such a cheesy song. Who is this singing? Willie Nelson? And then I turn back, and it's Vin Scully singing it. And they were playing this tape. And then the camera went in the crowds, and they showed a woman crying, and I'm sitting there going, oh, it's a woman. And then they showed a guy crying, and I'm sitting there going, huh. And all of a sudden, I find myself bawling. Because this was an end to part of my childhood. This was the voice of my dad listening to games. This is the voice of my dad and my uncles and the cousins. This is coming to an end. An era of baseball is coming to an end. And I think it's not an obsession, but it's an appreciation about him, goes back to my adolescence. Maybe I was 13 or 14. We're at Dodger Stadium, not corporately owned, by the way. And we're wanting autographs. We went there early for batting practice, and then we want autographs. So we're hanging around. We got nowhere to go. And our cousins are driving us, so we got time. So we're where the Dodgers come out, and there are their cars. It looks like those are professional baseball players' cars. And so they're coming out, and we're thinking, I hope I know the player's name, as we're walking with them to the car, asking for their autograph. And then you get the autograph, and you run back to your post. And you do this for a while. And then you realize, okay, I have nowhere to go. I'm just going to keep on hanging. Who else might come out? And who walks out but Vin Scully? So we're having this conversation. He's not hurried. He's not saying, hey, come with me as we get to my car. He's just chatting with us. He's asking us questions. We get autographs, and this is before phones, where you could take a picture of him, you know, as proof that you saw him. But he just wished us well. And we were thinking, players come, players go, but Vin Scully, we were at the right place at the right time. Many of us are looking for that perfect moment in our marriages. We're maybe waiting for an autograph, and then just then, it seems to happen. We're not fighting anymore. We lost the weight that we've gained in the last couple decades, and the sex life is dialed back to like newlywed days, and we got money, disposable income, and things are great. And you think to yourself, okay, this took no effort whatsoever. There was no sacrifice whatsoever. And then you realize, yeah, this is a mirage. This isn't marriage, because it's not that way in marriage. The truth is, to get to the right place, it takes time. Sometimes the right place doesn't feel like the good place. We want to be in the right place with our weight, but the treadmill and the keto diet or whatever diet is the latest fad, it's not working for us. It doesn't feel good. We want to be in the right place with our career, but the extra training and education doesn't feel good. We want to be free of debt, but saying no to cable and extras doesn't feel good. We want to be in the right place in our marriage, but compromise, seeing a counselor, working on old wounds, it doesn't feel good. In fact, some things take work and action to accomplish them. You're just not going to wake up tomorrow and find out that everything is better. To repeat a pivotal verse in this marriage series, John wrote in 1 John 3:18, "Dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth." And he was pretty much saying, hey, write a marriage series called Speechless, without words. If we want to love our spouse well and have a marriage that is right, we're going to have to not talk about it, and we're going to have to actually do some stuff about it. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 24 and 25, it says, "Do you not know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last." Anything we want in life, it's going to demand the right work at the right time to get the right result. I had the pleasure of coaching girls soccer for 20 years, and the last 7 were at varsity. And man, this is like a pinnacle opportunity. These are like prized athletes. They're disciplined. They know what it's like to battle, and they know what it's like to battle to stay in it, because the younger ones seem to be quicker. And speed and conditioning, it's part of it, but conditioning is meant to separate the girls from the women. Along comes the beep test. The beep test, if a girl has already done it before, they whimper. If they haven't done it before, they go, "Oh, the beep test, that sounds like fun." If you Google the beep test, it shows collegiate athletes, national teams, pro athletes, both genders. This test is meant to test endurance, and it kind of sees what kind of training have you already put in, so how far can you last. So you line up 2 cones 20 meters apart. All the girls are over here, and then when you start it, you have to get to the other set of cones, be there before it beeps, and then when it beeps, get to the other one, be there before it beeps, and back and forth it goes until it picks up speed. And it progressively comes faster. And then the flies start to fall. And then a certain number of athletes, they're kind of showing their conditioning base, and they're lasting. And then when it comes down to it, there's just a few. And then when it's one, everybody is just cheering them on to get to the next set of cones, get to the next cone, get to the next cone. And everybody's just pounding the ground because they want to see a personal best on that person's part. Because conditioning is helping them to prepare to last. And the last thing we want is a girl saying, "I'm tired, I want off the field." A few questions. How quickly will you exit your marriage? What will make you tap out of your marriage? How much stamina do you have? And then how badly do you want to have a thriving marriage? Average and status quo marriages, those are dime a dozen. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to work out. Just stay alive. But God's designed marriage so that we have to sacrifice to love each other. And then with pure motives, we're acting on their best interest, not on our own. And we're not trying to do it like you owe me one. I've only watched like 5 episodes of The Office. Never got it. I was a Seinfeld guy. Office was just too little weird, and all the camera angles just freaked me out. But I watched an episode about a month ago, and I said, hey, that'll fit in here. And it was the episode of You Owe Me One. And I think his name was Dwight. He comes in with bagels and says, "You want a bagel?" And then on his way out, he says, "You owe me one." And it was meant to like keep tracks, like you're having to pay them back. And that's not marital love. That's like roommate equality. This week, we're going to look at, in this old school, this 4-point message. In order to have the right marriage, you need to understand love right. You need to know your spouse's needs right, you need to see intimacy right, and you need to see God right. And to accomplish these, though, if you put in the work, you see the benefit in a relationship. And God created marriage to bring the best out in each other, and to do this all by the power of God, we sometimes find, okay, we have to deal with what's wrong. Maybe it's you personally, maybe it's you two together, and that's all good. That's a starting point. But we're finding out for us to put the work in, we might need to know that where we're off. My wife and I, Barclay, we were high school sweethearts. And in the yearbook, we were voted best couple. And we are. This was before she got a hold of my hair and said, yeah, the comb over. It's not going to last. The first time I met Barclay, I barked at her. And that got me on the idiot list. She thought when she moved from Missouri, people on the West Coast don't do that sort of dumb stuff anymore, but I barked at her and, yeah, I got put in the idiot list. And it's like the penalty box. You earn your time, and I've never made that mistake ever again. We both turned to Christ in our college years, and we resumed our relationship under new management of Jesus Christ. And this last December, we celebrated our 37th anniversary. Pretty cool. I'm not going to lie, we have enjoyed marital bliss. But we've also enjoyed disagreements and issues and problems, arguments, disappointments, because we're made different from each other. And we've resolved we're going to work through these issues. We've been there for each other, losing both sets of our parents and my sibling, my daughter, my sister. We were there when each of our 7 grandkids were born. We were there for each other in multiple surgeries, multiple major surgeries for each of us. We were there when our daughters were stolen from us to marry giant fans. There was one point where one of them wanted to date a Cincinnati Reds fan, and I said, no, no. Cincinnati's in last place, and the Giants are in last place, and the Dodgers are in first place, so it's as life should be, right? We were there when daughters had miscarriages. We were there when peers and friends experienced unfaithfulness and separation and divorce. We were there when some friends divorced and sometimes changed partners, like changing lanes on the freeway. But when other relationships went down, we ached and we hung on to each other. We clung a little closer. What I'd like to do today, this morning, is just to share with a room full of people. Many of you are married, and different stages of how successful and how strong. Some of you are single, maybe you're gonna be married. Some of you are divorced and still stinging from it, and maybe you will marry again. But maybe some words from a guy with 37 years in, and maybe you might learn from my failures, and you might also see some of my successes and realize that was God. But to have a right marriage, you need to deal with what's wrong, and you can't avoid it. And we're in this battle with you, and we're making it work. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 3 through 5, it says, the husband shall fulfill his marital duty to his wife. That's code for fooling around. And likewise, the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife. Do not deprive each other, except perhaps by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again, so Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Even before we get into the birds and bees, love has to be framed in your mind, dialed in for the other person. I think it was a book called Sex Begins in the Kitchen. Might have been an article, and I thought about Googling it, and then I thought, no, I'm not gonna. That could go bad. I'm sure Urban Dictionary would like go to town with that, but sex begins in the kitchen. During preparation of dinner, maybe dinner itself, maybe after dinner, it's actually possibly part of the husband and wife sex direction if everything goes according to romantic plans that night, but how are you treating the other person? How are you treating them right then? And you can't just, you can't think that it's just going to be a light switch when you get in bed. But what makes you think she's going to respond to your grunt later? It's sometimes a long on-ramp towards sex. The Apostle Paul, he's a little blunt as he writes about the intimate sex life for the husband and wife. I had a slightly creepy ninth grade sex ed teacher named Penelope Woodsmith, and I just changed her name just in case a high schooler friend of mine sees this, and she's still alive and she could sue me. But she was just, it was just a little too creepy that she was so zealous about the topic that she was teaching. You just wanted out of the classroom. And that was 46 years ago. But 2,000 years ago, the Apostle Paul writes, and he writes very straight, but he's writing to say that sex has to be understood as an integral part of a lasting relationship, a lasting marriage. To begin with, understand that your most influential sex organ is your brain. Because how you choose to think about your spouse in love is like starting point. My first couple points that come from the last few weeks, but point number one, understand love right. Understand love right. In the book of Ephesians and then in 1 Peter, it starts out with a little heading, submit to one another in love. And then it goes on to delineate words to the husband, then to the wife, then to the children, then to employers, employees, and it pretty much says in the social context of other people, submit yourselves to other people. And submission is a please go before me sort of attitude. And it's like genuine. Has nothing to do with like if you're driving your car and you come to an intersection and someone's supposed to go first and then you're ticked at them because they didn't go first. You're supposed to go first. I'm not gonna go anymore. I'm just turning my car off and I'm just gonna sit here. That submission has nothing to do with this submission. And oh my gosh, on Woodward and now the interstate road that's coming in at Union and 120 and all the yields, I don't know if people get yield, and I don't know if I get it. But in a marriage relationship, yielding or submitting yourself is something you must get down. In a marriage relationship, submitting to the other means you're thinking more of their interests, more of your own, on a continual basis, and it's not because you're trying to be on your best behavior because it's a holiday or an anniversary or maybe a romantic night. You need to reset your brain to understand love right. Before you even think about sex, get that love element down and understand that love does not equate sex. So understand love right. Second, know your spouse's needs right. Know your spouse's needs right. Your spouse's needs begin where your responsibility lies. With your brain, seek to know and understand what their needs are. There's a great book called His Needs, Her Needs. You want to get that. Get it on Amazon, get it used. Get very good condition. But just have that book to understand how do I pick their brain to understand what their needs are. Because you're going to be tested on that. You don't want to fail there. Ephesians 5:21 says, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Then verse 22 says, wives. And it gives three verses about how to submit to that husband and letting him lead, and that will translate as respect. Then it says husbands, then it gives nine verses to describe how to submit to the lady of the house by loving her. And loving her is going to be his greatest challenge and her greatest need. But needs in your spouse's life, they may not be surface level. You might not be a psychiatrist or a counselor, but you're responsible to try and pick their brain. How are you doing on that? How are you maybe digging at that? And those needs, they might be just this last week, they might be last month, they might be last year, and they might be in their childhood. Something, you know, hard that they cannot overcome, and you talking about it is healthy. Pastor Brian discussed the book called Five Love Languages, great book. Words of affirmation, acts of service, receiving gifts, quality time, and physical touch. And those are all valuable. If you go to crossroadsgrace.org/marriage, I think you'll see wedding marriage resources, and it's a great book to read. 1 Peter 3:7 in the New American Standard says, you husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way. So above this in 1 Peter 3:7, it says, submit to one another. And then it said, wives. And then it says, you husbands in the same way. So he's pretty much saying this all goes back to submit one another. And husbands, this is how you do it. Live with your wives, singular, one wife at a time. Live with your wives in an understanding way, meaning in a knowing way, meaning your brain is engaged, meaning they're like a project to you. You're trying to crack the code. What makes them tick? You're wondering about them. Live with your wives in an understanding way. I think NIV says live with your wives in a considerate way, but that word knowing has to do with understanding. We're to care for our spouse and try and understand them. And there's sometimes when I attack a project that I'll be attacking this for a while. I'm thinking it through. I'm getting all my ducks in a row. I'm making sure I got the tools, making sure I know the sequence and I have everything. And in life, how you approach things should show that you put forethought into it. And then your forethought should almost show. So a couple mistakes of mine, guys, you don't want to do this. On Valentine's Day, I got my wife flowers, big expensive flowers, and I had them delivered. Now, back in the day, we lived near LA. She used to get in the car at 6:30 in the morning. She'd downtown LA, she was in a high rise in the fashion industry, and she would get home at 7:30 or 8 at night. And so I had the flowers delivered to the house after she got home. She could have enjoyed them all Valentine's Day long, and then had the accolades of all of her workmates kind of going, man, you got a special husband. Yeah, I do. But I got them delivered to the house where me and the dog were. So it's just the timing. It was like swinging at a ball when the ball's already in the glove. It was the wrong timing. So if you're going to spend money and good money, that was an arrangement, think it through. You should show better forethought than I did. Another blunder of mine was on Mother's Day. I got her a card, and I gave it to her at night. And that was after church, so that I could get a card on the way home and then get the card and, you know, sit over here and write the card. And then you lick it, and then it doesn't take anything to tear it apart. There just wasn't forethought in that. If you do celebrate something like this, get that stuff the night before, and on the table in the kitchen is the best place for that, like the night before, not the night of. You don't get points, so learn from my mistakes. She doesn't want you fixing her, but she does want to know that you're thinking deeply about her and wondering how to meet the needs in her life. To have the right marriage, you need to understand love right, you need to understand your spouse's needs right, and then three, you need to understand intimacy right. So a product of intimacy are children. So if you're a parent and you've got children, have you had the sex talk with them? If you haven't, by the time of 8 and 10, well, their friends are going to tell them what sex is all about. Their friends at school, you know, their experienced classmates. And then in classroom setting, if it's the public school system, God bless them, my kids did public school and survive. But in the public school system, they're gonna explain sex without God, without morality, and then they're gonna cram an agenda on your family tree. And so it's up to us, have we had those conversations at home? And I'm gonna circle back to this. But I got the talk from my mom while my brother and I were in the back seat of the Mercury Montego, driving down I-5 and Dodger Stadium's over on the right, and my brother and I realized, oh my gosh, we're getting the talk. And my mom is delivering it. So I don't know if the night before, mom lost, but the talk was lame. And my folks have both passed away. I really should have made fun of them while they were alive to say, so what was that all about? Dads, you need to talk to your sons. Moms, you need to talk to your daughters. Talk straight. Yep, it's going to be uncomfortable. Yep, expect follow-up conversations. And if you're a single parent, then you're doing double duty. We tip our hat. We respect you. Thank you for serving in both ways. But God's the one who created sex, and he talks about it a lot in the Bible. If we covered all the verses that are in the Bible, a lot of you would say, let's go, hon. This is getting weird. There's some strange scripture in the Bible talking about sex. We're not covering it all, but there is this text at hand, 1 Corinthians 7, that I want to talk about. And basically it says the husband should fulfill his marital duty. That's fooling around. And then the next slide. It does talk about do not deprive each other, except for a time. Then it says, come together again. There's instructions about sex that just say it's part of being married. It's almost like the Santa Claus, the clause about Santa Claus, and it's written around the edges on the outside of it. Sex is part of marriage. So you're supposed to have sex. Be biblical. Maybe you pull up the Crossroads app or 1 Corinthians 7, and maybe at night you might kind of say something like, hey, babe, want me to read you scripture? I just pulled a Brian. The word fulfill means it's a longing of another. Sex binds lives. It's not in a legal, contractual sense, but in a heart longing sense. Why did God create this experience of sex and then label it a duty or responsibility? I believe one reason is that it's experiencing a physical relationship with another that continues to meld lives together, and it protects each other from the exploration elsewhere drive. I've watched some people wander from their marriage in wretched ways and to pursue a fascination of sex as depraved as a hungry coyote. But I've also met some men, and I've never talked to women about this. Don't talk to women about this. Just talk to men. Keep it on the same gender thing. But I've talked to men who just kind of said, yeah, we don't have a sex life anymore due to our health, due to physical age. And it's just not that big of a deal as it was decades earlier. But it's part of the memory that they have and companionship built by years of emotional deposits that then would be the fruit of years of devotion to each other. In my student ministry days, I would say often, the first glance is free. But the second glance, after you become aware of what you glanced at, the second glance or the continuing glance, that will cost you. If your eyes work, they're the gateway to your brain. If your eyes work and you see stuff, you need to, as Pastor Mike used to say, you need to bounce your eyes. You need to redirect it. You're watching a game with a family and all of a sudden Victoria's Secret ad comes on. You need to say, just in, to yourself, you don't have to say it out loud, nope, and then look away. Just whenever you see something, think, nope, and look away. And I hope your children look at you as they did at me when Victoria's Secret ads came on and they looked at me just to see what I was going to do. I have never been gut hooked by porn yet, but I am scared speechless of it because I have seen it destroy individuals. I've seen it destroy families. I know of some children who don't talk to one of their parents because it was such an abusive issue. But I don't want to go down. Noticing is one thing. Going back for seconds and appreciating, that'll cost you. The eye gate, it's your first step toward further action. Job 31:1 says, I've made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a girl. And that word covenant, that's like a one-way commitment. That's not a contract. Hey, if I do this, you'll do this. A covenant is you stating something one way, and I'm just going to make this decision. I'm not going to look lustfully at a girl. I remember texting a guy saying, I didn't look back. And then later on, I'd text him saying, oh my goodness, I wanted to look back, but I didn't look back. And I was texting a guy who had had issues in his life. And it was a friendship mentor relationship. And I was helping him say, in small ways, these are what I'm noticing, and this is what how I'm choosing to react to it. And at one point, he said, so it looks like, dang, you've like covered the bases. You've conquered that. You don't look back anymore. And it's kind of like, no, I haven't won the battle completely yet, but I'm scared spitless to go down the trail that other people have gone down. So I choose to look away. And how often I do that, that's a small victory for me. Newspaper ads, TV ads, women's clothing magazines, they're all steps. Women, if you get those magazines, you got clothes from that place one time, cancel the subscription and then let them send it to you again in the future. But don't send it to the house and don't think that the guy might not notice the mail, especially if you send us out for the mail. I was at Costco the other day, and here's a picture of, you know, like a woman's rear end in the underwear, and I'm kind of going, really? If you have cable and it's not secured, you're exposing yourself to Russian roulette. And I'm not sure, but I bet there's channels for Russian hotties, Russian singles, Russians. Click on one of those emails that you think is slimy. If you find out it is, you just bit on the hook. A consistent sex life at home, it's an investment in your heart and future together, and it helps minds and other sex organs to not wander. It says, come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of control. Come together again. It's a biblical command. Married boys and girls, feel free to quote the Apostle Paul, but not me. Close to this subject, but not right out of the text. Paul says that sex is between the husband and the wife. Porn should not have any role in your life. Not for pregame, not for your own personal individual, and not for you as a couple. It will ruin you. Porn is alluring, but it's not fulfilling. And porn is so addictive. I've never tried crack cocaine, but I think it's as addictive. I've never tried cocaine yet. I'm on my guard. And porn is so harmful to your soul and your sex life. You need to break all ties and distance yourself from it. Males, you're most susceptible, but women are too. I was sent some articles about porn for women and how it's so magnetic, and I just couldn't come up with the right way to put links in here. But it's as damaging for them as it is for us. And it's as widespread, it's everywhere, it's outside and inside the church, and it's inside these walls right here. And I bet there are some people right now that sex addiction or porn is like an addiction for some of you. God can help you break free. You gotta break free. You're gonna ruin part of your legacy if you don't. Couples, have sex frequently to keep the fires at home burning and to also save your marriage and protect it. Non-married couples, wait on sex. Don't test the plumbing, it works. Hebrews chapter 13 says, marriage should be honored by all, and the marriage bed kept pure, for God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral. Don't live married if you are not married. Don't play being married. And I'd encourage you, don't just get married because you think that it'll fix you. We try and slow people down in getting married here. Paul the Apostle said, I wouldn't advise getting married, but if you got to get married, okay. I'm going to tell you, I told you so. But don't think that getting married will fix everything in your life. But I'm also encouraging you, don't live together. Don't look like you're married. You got to buy the toothbrush before you try it out. You got to put a ring on the finger. Non-married individuals, wait on sex, even if you're not with anyone yet. So this is some straight talk, but God says I'm trying to spare society, so I'm trying to lay it out as clear as I can to say this is how it works and this is how it will work best and this is how you have a right marriage. Four keys on the physical life. First of all, sex is not a distraction. It's not a distraction. You can't just sweep your problems under the sheets and think it's going to be all better in the morning. Second, sex is not a weapon. We can't use sex or the lack of it as like a way to get our own way. Third, sex is not to be taken casually. Maybe for you singles especially, don't think of sex as just what everyone else does. But it's a mingling of souls. And it's something that will bind you in a way that you can't unbind without a little bit of tearing. I used to teach in student ministry, Pinky and Blue, and I bring it out periodically when we had new students. And if you're in student ministry for 20 years, you know, like graduate out, you can use some of your old jokes. I bring out Pinky and Blue, and a sheet of pink paper and a sheet of blue paper, and then Elmer's glue, and I hold it together, and maybe 30, 45 seconds, and then I pull it apart. And you would see little strands of pink on the blue and little strands of blue in the pink. And that sort of effect on another is going to happen when sex is taken casually. It's not meant to be. Before we pastors agree to marry anybody, we sit down with them and we talk about four things. We want to make sure that you're both Christians or you're both non-Christians. We can't marry an apple and an orange. Then we talk about premarital counseling, and it's just part of it. And then we talk about your living arrangements. Then we talk about your sex life, because you're wanting us to marry you and put our stamp on you, and we're trying to help you last. And we believe that by abstaining now, it increases your odds of lasting together later. And I'd love to buy any of you couples coffee or In-N-Out if you want to sit down and talk about this issue itself. It'll be uncomfortable, but we'll get over it. Point four, sex needs to be talked about. It needs to be talked about. I know the series is called Speechless, but conversation about sex happens less often than you think, because it's embarrassing and it's awkward. But by not talking about it, or not addressing it, or not talking about what the sexual needs are of your partner, it's dangerous. And it puts a distance between you two. So in order to have a right marriage, understand love right, understand your spouse's needs right, understand intimacy right, and fourth point is understand, see God right. See God right. I got a D in ceramics. For me, art, anything artistic, stick men. I can't do a good-looking stick man. I'm not an artist in any way, but I showed up to class so they couldn't flunk me. And the one thing that I really learned about the class is that to make anything on the wheel as it's spinning, you have to get your hands wet, and then you have to center the clay. If you don't center the clay, forget it. It's not gonna work. And centering the clay has to do with applying pressure and pushing towards the center. So if God created marriage, and he created you, and he's laid out all sorts of intel on how to act with one another in a marriage relationship, doesn't it make sense to see God right, centered in your life? Dr. Phil, he could help you with tips on how to be less of a jerk than today's show began, but God's the one who could help you understand yourself and your spouse better than ever before. Let me tell you a short story about a couple who didn't start seeing God right until later in their relationship. Nate and Angie Grotberg, they grew up in the same town in high school up in Minnesota, where they play hockey and they have the O, Minnesota. They weren't sweethearts then, but then they reconnected in California after Nate had met someone and it had a daughter named Hannah. Nate and Angie fell in love. They got pregnant before they got married, and so they hastefully, quickly got married. And then 5 years into their relationship, they separated. They were dealing with real issues of communication, intimacy, and connecting. Divorce papers were all written up, and all they had to do was like hand it to the other person. But God wasn't allowing them to follow through on the divorce. And in the delay, Nate and Angie found Jesus, bringing them back together with a newfound depth of appreciation. Their perception of marriage changed with a new understanding of being selfless and serving each other. And then seeing God right in their relationship with each other. Last Wednesday, they celebrated their 9th anniversary. in a room such as this, some of you, your stories are soon to be written through your actions. Let's pray. God, thanks that you care for us. Thanks that you showed marriage as this beautiful explanation of Jesus and his bride, the church. There's a waiting period right now for your return, for the marriage supper of the Lamb. That's going to happen when your bride is perfectly ready. Right now, you're primping out the bride. It's all about the bride. You're intricately involved in our relationships. And as we deal with each other as individuals, God, help us to get out of the way of you being able to show your great love for the other. But God, with us in the way, you're going to involve us in helping the other. Thanks for what's ahead. Thanks that you care for us. Thanks that you watch us. Thanks that you notice us. Thanks that we make you smirk. There's stuff about you that you're waiting for us to discover. But God, thanks that you care for us and you've loved us and you've shown us that in Jesus. Amen.